I want to ask, how many of you have ever been to downtown Washington, D.C.? I'd just like to see your hand. Leave it up so I can see how many. Many of you, yes. All right, put your hands down. I can remember being there before they had GPSs, and I had a map, and I was driving by myself. It took me 2 hours to get unlost in Washington, D.C. It seems like every time I come to a stoplight, I'm scrambling with the map trying to find where I am, and the next thing I know, everybody's honking at me and rude East Coast people. You know, I had to go, and I don't know where I am. One of the things I do remember about downtown Washington, D.C. was the hustle and bustle of the place. Millions and millions of people there, right? A subway system, sidewalks with people scrambling to and fro. I mean, kind of a crazy place to visit. Now, the sidewalks were especially interesting to me when I visited Washington, D.C. It's because they were littered with vendors. Do you remember that from your visit? I mean, some of them were legally set up, and most of them were not. They were quite, kind of like squatters. They would find their territory of sidewalk, and some of them would throw out a blanket and be selling. I mean, you can buy just about anything on the streets of Washington, D.C. Just about anything. You have these vendors. Some of them are in little booths. Other ones have just a blanket on the sidewalk. And other ones, I kind of called them mobile vendors. It's because they had these trench coats. Did anyone see these guys? They have trench coats, and inside the trench coats, they had little hooks or little pockets, and they had their wares inside their trench coat, and they would kind of walk up and kind of walk like this, like Batman wings, you know, walking around with their trench coats. But there would be like watches, Rolex watches, Oakley sunglasses. I'll never forget the Oakley sunglasses. I mean, because there was a time when I was looking for a pair of sunglasses, and I mean, Oakley's, I mean, what are they, like 150, 250? Do I hear 350? Do I hear, you know what I mean? Oakley's, right? And here's this dude, and he's selling them for $10. Like, sweet. Now, can you imagine going to this guy that's walking around the streets of Washington, D.C. with a black trench coat and a series of Oakley glasses he's selling for $10, and you pick up a pair. You buy a pair for $10, and then you go to the next guy, and he's got Rolex watches, and you buy that for $7. And you go back here to the great state of Utah, and you're walking around campus with your bling bling Rolex watch flopping around. You know, you want everybody to see Rolex, and you've got your cool sunglasses on with a big O. And you start telling your friends how you bought these. You're like, you'd never believe it. Washington, D.C. is the greatest place in the world. Everything's on sale. Everything. I mean, I got these $300 Oakleys for $10. And I got this $1,000 Rolex for $7. Now, what do you think your friend is going to do at that point? They're going to start laughing at you. That's what they're going to do. They're going to say, those aren't real. Those aren't real Oakleys. Those that's not a Rolex watch. Those aren't real because they weren't sold from an authorized dealer. You got them off the streets. Those are a gimmick. They're a cheap copy. It's not the real thing. My friends, do you realize what was happening in Galatia? These Judaizers, these people from Jerusalem, these Jews came down to the region of Galatia. They followed the path where Paul was, and they began to say, Paul's gospel, that's like a cheap Rolex. That's like a fake pair of Oakleys. It's not the real thing. Paul has some sort of a gimmick gospel. He's poached it off of people like Peter, but it's not the true gospel. These people from Jerusalem, the Judaizers of the book of Galatia, they were going around saying that Paul was some sort of ragtag street vendor with a cheap gospel that he was distributing abroad. Their claim was that the only true gospel must come from an authorized dealer. It must come from Jerusalem, where the other apostles are. And so they were spreading this rumor about Paul, that he had cheapened the gospel, that what he was teaching was not true. And so what Paul does in the letter of Galatians is he begins to respond, and he makes a case that has 2 points. He's going to combat these Judaizers and their false theory about his gospel. He's going to combat it with a case that hinges on two points. His first point is going to be that he's not a trademark thief. Instead, he's a true servant of Christ. So Paul's going to emphasize, I'm a true servant of Christ. And then from there, he's going to say, I'm not giving you some cheap imitation gospel. Actually, it's an authentic message from Christ. So Paul's going to argue two points. I'm a servant of Christ with a message from Christ. And in the end, he's going to call us to respond to Christ. So this morning, I'd like to break down his argument. Remember, the Judaizers are claiming he's got cheap Oakleys and fake Rolex. That's the sort of gospel he was distributing. And he's going to make the argument and say, no, I am a true servant of Christ. I have a true message from Christ. So let's see if we can unpack this from the text this morning. The passage we're going to look at starts in verse number 10 of Galatians 1 and works its way down through the end of the chapter. The first claim Paul makes, his first point in his argument, is this: I am a servant of Christ. It'd be like saying, I am an authorized Apple distributor. I am a true Rolex salesman. I have the real, I am truly a servant of Christ. That's what he's going to claim first. Notice it in verse number 10. In verse number 10, Paul says this: am I now seeking the approval of man or God? Isn't that a great question? I mean, stop and think about your own life for a minute. Whose approval are you seeking? Everyone lives for the approval of someone. Whose approval do you seek? Well, Paul says here, am I seeking the approval of man or of God? Or am I trying to please man? If I were still trying to please man, I would not be a servant of Christ. What is Paul claiming? I'm a servant of Christ, a true servant of Christ. I'm not some people pleaser. That's not how I live my life. I don't walk around just trying to sell a cheap imitation gospel so that crowds will gather to me. I'm not trying to sell as many products as possible. That's not what I'm doing. I'm a true servant of Christ, not a people pleaser. I think at the end of the day, Paul knew the difference between people pleasers and true servants. He knew the difference. You know, people pleasers are motivated by the fear of man. Servants of Christ, they're motivated by the fear of God. You know, people pleasers, they pretend to serve God. But usually, it's as a means to serve themselves. So they'll use religion, they'll use whatever it is, but in some way they get the benefit. People pleasers do that. But God pleasers, they are servants of Christ, and they serve Him, and they serve others, and it's for His glory alone. People pleasers, they're anxious for the approval of others, and they're distraught when they don't get it. Servants of Christ, they do what's right to love others, to love God, and they let the approval happen what will happen. That's what true servants of Christ do. Well, Paul is here, and he's saying, I'm not a people pleaser. I am a true servant of Christ. I'm not out to promote my own publicity. I am seeking to live for the pleasure of God. Are you a people pleaser? Or are you a true servant of Christ? I want to suggest this. People pleasers don't make good servants of Christ. They just don't. So if you're living to please other people, you're not going to be a good servant of Christ. That's the premise of verse 10, isn't it? Listen, am I seeking the approval of man or am I seeking the approval of God? Am I trying to please man? Because if that's what I do, Paul says, I wouldn't be a servant of Christ. People pleasers don't make good servants of Christ. Let me give you three reasons why. Three reasons why people pleasers don't make good servants of Christ. The first one is this: because people pleasers will cave underneath pressure. That's why they don't make good servants of Christ. They'll cave. Like when there are influential people around, then they're going to bend or compromise. People pleasers are kind of like the flowers that you get that your husband brings home because he was rude and mean and he's trying to make up, and so he stops by Walmart. buys these expensive flowers. He brings them home and you put them on the kitchen table and they're all standing straight up. They're perfectly coming out of the vase. They're all like this. And the window's over here, right? And about an hour later, you look at these flowers and what's going on? They're all like this. They've all bent over towards something. I want to say this. People pleasers will bend. They'll cave underneath pressure. They'll compromise when influential people are around. People pleasers won't stand strong. They long for the acceptance of others. They desire the praise of other people. They seek to earn affection. They work hard to get people's good opinion. That's how they live their life. Imagine the insecure freshman. Just got to the U. Hanging out with some of the frat guys. And all of a sudden, this insecure freshman begins to compromise certain things. Certain things he believes in his heart. And why? Because he wants to be accepted, right? How about this insecure female? All of a sudden, she starts compromising in certain areas of her life so that this guy will really like her. How about this new employee? He's an entry-level employee into the business. And pretty soon, he starts volunteering for all the Sunday shifts just to show everybody he's a real hard worker. But in doing so, he begins to compromise certain things about his life. If you live for the pleasure of people instead of the pleasure of God, you will find yourself caving, bending, compromising under the weight of other people's opinions. The pressure of influential people in our lives can tempt us to compromise our gospel-rooted principles. So I want to ask you right up front, what are your gospel-rooted principles? What is it that roots your life? Then let me ask you this, have you been caving? Have you been bending? Have you been compromising because of the pressure of other people? If so, then you're living as a people pleaser and not as a servant of Christ. See, where do you get this? Well, I'm just going to survey Galatians just a little bit to show you this case. Remember, people pleasers cave underneath pressure. Well, in chapter 2, we're going to find a story. We're not going to preach that this morning. We'll get to chapter 2, but I just want to give you a hint there. In chapter 2, right at the beginning of the chapter, Paul is going to go to Jerusalem. It's after 13 years. There he's going to go down to Jerusalem, 14 years. He goes down to Jerusalem, and he takes a Greek with him named Titus. When he gets down to Jerusalem, there are people that wanted Titus, a Greek, a Gentile, to conform to the Jewish standard of law, specifically with the sign of circumcision. And Paul says this, it's actually a very interesting verse, chapter 2, verse 5. To them, we did not yield in submission even for a moment, so that the truth of the gospel might be preserved for you. So Paul goes to the epicenter of the Christian church. That's at Jerusalem. He gets there. That's where the apostles are. That's where the influential people are. And he brings with him a Christian Gentile. And when he gets to Jerusalem, people start pressuring him. Oh, you have to be under the law. You have to manifest the sign of the law, the sign of the covenant of Abraham. You have to do this. Now, what would a people pleaser have done? A people pleaser would have made Titus undergo circumcision so that he was in submission to the law. But Paul says this, no, I'm not a people pleaser. I won't bend even for a second so that the truth of the gospel might not be blurred here. I want to preserve it for you. Paul was not a people pleaser. He did not cave under pressure. Instead, he was a true servant of Christ. He wasn't worried about winning people's approval. He was worried about winning God's approval. So, how has your week been? Did you find yourself caving under pressure? Did you find yourself compromising your gospel-rooted principles? My friends, if you're living as a people pleaser, then you are not living as a servant of Christ. People pleasers don't make good servants of Christ because, number one, they cave under pressure. Number two, they're afraid to confront. That's why people pleasers aren't good servants of Christ. They're afraid to confront other people. They'd rather kind of cower. They don't want to risk it. They're like, well, if I say something to them, they might not be my friend anymore. If I talk to them about this issue in their life, our relationship might suffer. They're afraid to confront other people. They don't want to risk being rejected. They don't want any relational fallout. And so they steer clear of confrontation. Now, let me just say this. You've got to be a little twisted to like confrontation. I mean, that means you're warped inside. But if you're a true servant of Christ, then it means that most likely in your life, you're going to have to lovingly confront someone. That's because we live in a community of people who are sinners. It means sometimes we have to have hard, honest conversations. But a people pleaser won't do that. They'll run away from those hard conversations. They're not willing to speak the truth in love because they're afraid to confront. Well, again, let me give you a quick case study of Paul. He's not a people pleaser. He's willing to confront. And what's interesting is he's willing to confront someone of great stature. Notice chapter 2, verse 11. I'm going to fast forward to you just a second here. Chapter 2, verse 11. Anyone know who Cephas is? Because it starts out, it says, when Cephas came to Antioch. It comes from the Aramaic kepha, meaning stone or rock. Anyone know who that is? It's Peter, yes. So he's talking about the Apostle Peter. So here's Peter. He came to Antioch. So the lead apostle comes to Antioch. And look what Paul says. He says, I opposed him to his face. Can you imagine going toe-to-toe with the Apostle Peter? Here's Paul, and he says, listen, when Peter came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face. Why was it? Well, as the passage unfolds, what you find is that Peter had been fellowshipping with other Gentiles and even eating with them, and that was fine. They were Christian believers. They were brothers and sisters in Christ. He would eat with them. But when influential people from Jerusalem came down, these other Jews came down, Peter dissed all of the Gentiles. He said, oh, I can't eat with you guys anymore. And he pulls his little race card out. And Paul goes up to him and says, you're going to be a racist? That's what he does. I mean, he looks right at Peter and says, you're going to blur the gospel by separating from these Gentiles? You're a hypocrite. Wow. I don't know about you, but Paul wasn't winning any. That's not like a way to gain friends and influence people. You know, go to the lead apostle and tell him he's a hypocrite right to his face in front of other people. No. But I want to tell you something. Paul was exactly right, wasn't he? Because Peter was being a hypocrite, and Peter was blurring the truth of the gospel. And so Paul was not a people pleaser. He was willing to confront sin. I want to ask you something. In your friendships, like look around to the people you're friends with. Are you willing to confront your friend with truth if they need it? Are you willing? Let me ask you this. Are you willing to confront your spouse? Whoa,
Lucas. When mama ain't happy, there ain't nobody happy. Lucas, haven't you heard it said? Happy wife, happy life. Right? I don't confront her.
My friend, are you willing to confront even your spouse? Are you willing to confront a friend? Are you willing to confront a brother or sister in Christ in love? Because the truth is at stake. People pleasers won't do it. People pleasers will run away from confrontation. But Paul wasn't a people pleaser. He was a servant of Christ. So he didn't cave under pressure, and he was willing to confront other people. When we're more worried about our own reputation than we are about truth, it means we're people pleasers. When we'd rather have approval from other people than wholeness in the body of Christ, it means we're people pleasers. When we refuse to confront sin, we're cowards, not Christ-like. We're people pleasers, not servants of the Lord. Well, that wasn't Paul. Paul's a servant of Christ. That's his first point he's trying to make. I'm not a people pleaser because I don't cave under pressure. I don't refuse to confront sin. Here's his last point underneath there. He says, I'm not a people pleaser because I'm not shamed by Christ. What do you mean by that? Well, there were a great many people who wanted to be what I would call fair weather Christians. They're like the people when Super Bowl time comes around Whoever wins the Super Bowl, they buy that jersey. You're like, pfft. They're fair weather fans. Oh, they won, so I'm there. I'm a fan of that. Yeah, okay, okay. No, that wasn't it. There are some people that are like that with Christ. As long as Christianity is acceptable, as long as that's the in thing, as long as that's kind of cool with my friends, then yeah, I'm into the Christian thing. That's great. But as soon as people are like, huh, what? Then all of a sudden we become silent. Oh, yeah, yeah, I'll be a Christian as long as my classmates don't have to know. Yeah, yeah, I'm gonna be a Christian as long as my beliefs don't have to enter the public square. Oh, yeah, 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 I'll be a Christian as long as my coworkers stay in the dark. Paul was not ashamed of Christ. He wasn't ashamed of Christ's cross. Paul didn't partition off Christ and be like, yeah, 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 Christ, Christian, that's stuff for Sunday. The rest of the week, let's keep it on the down low, okay? I don't want to be called one of those Jesus people, those crazy Christian people. I don't want people to know that. Let's just keep it on the down low. No, that's what a people pleaser does. A people pleaser hides from the shame of Christ, but Paul wouldn't do that. Actually, Paul was willing to follow Christ and his cross. In Luke chapter 9, verse 23, Jesus looked at people who wanted to follow him. There were people who said, hey, what do I have to do to follow you, Jesus? And Jesus looks at him and says this, if any man will follow after me, let him deny himself. Does anyone know the next phrase? Take up his cross daily and follow me. See, if you're going to follow Christ, it means you deny yourself. People pleasers aren't willing to do that. If you're going to follow Christ, if you're going to be his servant, you deny yourself and you take up his cross. The shame of his cross. The abuse of his cross. The sufferings of his cross. Are you willing to suffer for Jesus? I mean, some people, they are such deeply ingrained as people pleasers, they won't even endure a chuckle or a laugh. I couldn't have my friends laugh at me. Oh, yeah, I mean the suffering, the depth of suffering. Someone might laugh at you. But I'm going to tell you, there are people pleasers who won't bring up Christ. They won't speak his name. They won't bow their head and pray. They won't do these things because someone might laugh. Oh, my friends, then you're far from a cross. You may think you're a great Christian, but you have not even begun to know what it means to take up a cross. Paul says, I am not a people pleaser. I am a servant of Christ, and I bear underneath the shame of Christ. I bear underneath the cross of Christ. That's what Paul says. I mean, Paul would go into cities, and do you know what he would preach? I preached nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. That's what Paul preached. And you know what that got him? He got laughed at. He got mocked. He was beat up. He was driven from cities. He was whipped. He was scorned. He was beaten with rods. He was stoned. That's what it got him. But he wasn't a people pleaser. He was a servant of Christ. And so he bore underneath the shame, the ridicule, the humiliation of the cross. He wouldn't be silenced. He wouldn't box it up. Oh, listen, I've got to pursue my education in this sphere. Christ is over in this sphere. No, no, no. Christ is life. For me to live, Paul said, is Christ. For me to live is Christ. It's the air I breathe. He didn't box it up. He didn't partition it off. Instead, he made Christ and his cross the motto of his life. He made it the battle cry of his message. When I came to you, brothers, 1 Corinthians chapter 2, I did not come proclaiming to you a testimony of God with lofty speech or wisdom, for I decided to know nothing among you save Jesus Christ and him crucified. Jews demand a sign. Greeks seek wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified. That's what Paul says. You know, it's interesting. Actually, in this book, in the book of Galatians, in chapter number 6, why don't you just see this phrase? You can underline it if you'd like. It's right at the end of the book. Galatians chapter 6, verse number 17. Look at the end of verse 17. Paul says this, I bear on my body, do you see that there? The marks of Jesus. You know what that means? When you picture Jesus, you may remember that he was whipped, a crown of thorns was placed on his head, he was beaten with rods, he was finally crucified and pierced through with a spear. He died for the sins of people like you and me. Paul says, I bear in my body the marks of Jesus. Do you know Paul had scars across his back too? Jesus was scourged, but Paul was too. These thick scars across his back. He had pieces in his flesh that were probably messed up a little bit, because I'm going to tell you, you can't be stoned two times and like walk away with like a model figure. They didn't have cosmetic surgery back then. No, he bore in his body the marks of the Lord. He wasn't ashamed of that. My friends, people pleasers run from the shame of the cross. They run from it. But servants of Christ, they boast in it. That's the difference. Paul says in Galatians 6, you're still in chapter 6, look at verse number 14. Far be it from me to boast except in the cross of our Lord Jesus Christ, by which the world has been crucified to me and I to the world. Paul boasted in the cross. He wasn't silent in critical moments. He didn't compromise in pressured situations. He didn't slip away from embarrassment. No, he bore in his body the marks of Christ. He boasted in Christ's cross. My friend, if you're a people pleaser, it's not just a character flaw. It's actually idolatry. It's a serious dilemma you're struggling with this morning if you find that you're a people pleaser. Because what it means is that you've given inordinate worth to man and inadequate worth to God. You care more about what people think than what God thinks. You long for the and crave for the approval of people instead of living for the approval of God. And that, my friends, is idolatry. If you truly long to be a servant of Christ, then he must become the object of your affection and the end of your ambition. Anything else will fall short. God's gracious approval must be appropriated in your life, and it must be enough. Enough. Only then will we be servants of Christ instead of people pleasers. I don't know what you aim for at the end of life. I don't know what words you long to hear from Christ, but I want to tell you there is a line that I long to hear from my Lord one day. Well done, thou good and faithful servant. Friend, if we live as people pleasers, we will never hear those words. We must be servants of Christ. That's what Paul is claiming here. He says, my friends, I'm not a cheap vendor peddling some imitation gospel. I am a true servant of Christ. That's Paul's first point. Here's his second point. I'm a servant of Christ with a message from Christ. What Paul was preaching was a message that came from God. It was a divine message. So Paul is going to do this. He's going to say, listen, there's no human source. There's no human voice behind my message. It has divine origin. Paul's going to say here, my message came from Christ. Somebody didn't invent this. Some man didn't come up with this. This came from Christ. Let me show you how he breaks that down in our text. Go back to Galatians 1. He's going to show us first that it's not an invention. So again, this message is from Christ. That means it's not some human invention. Verse number 11, look what he says there. I would have you know, brothers, that the gospel that was preached by me is not man's gospel. You see what he's saying here? He's saying, listen, my message is from Christ. It's not man's message. It's not human invention. Verse 12, I did not receive it from any man, nor was I taught it, but I received it through a revelation of Jesus Christ. It's not an invention. Paul didn't sit by himself in a yoga pose and have some sort of meditation experience by which he reflected long enough to come up with the gospel. That's not what happened. He didn't reason it out. He didn't think it out. He didn't have some deep introspection or some creative brainstorming session. That's not what happened with this gospel. It was not invented by Paul. That's what he's saying here. It's not an invention. He goes on, he says, it's not a tradition. So not only did I not come up with it, but I didn't get it from somebody else. Notice verse number 12, he says, nor was I taught it. I didn't receive this from somebody else. I didn't sit down with the other apostles, and the apostles sat me down, and they gave me a four-year seminar on gospel equipping. Paul says, no, that's not what happened. I didn't receive this from the other gospel. This isn't some tradition that I received. And he explains this. Notice verse number 16. He wants to prove that he didn't get this from Jerusalem. That it's not just some copy, some cheap imitation, some second-hand, second-rate gospel from the apostles in Jerusalem. That's not what happened. In verse 16, his first point is, listen, I was in Arabia. Look at verse 16. It says that God calls him by his grace. Verse 16, he was pleased to reveal his son to me in order that I might preach him among the Gentiles. I did not immediately consult with anyone, nor did I go up to Jerusalem to those who were apostles before me, but I went away into Arabia and returned again to Damascus. Verse 18 says, for how long? How long was he there? 3 years. 3 years. So what Paul is saying here is, I didn't invent this. It's not an invention. The gospel is not a tradition. I didn't run to Jerusalem, sit down with the 12 apostles, and have them teach me. He says, no, I was actually out in Arabia, in the desert. He said, I didn't confer. The Greek there says this. I didn't confer with flesh or blood. I didn't confer with any human person. That's not what happened. I was in Arabia. I didn't go to Jerusalem until 3 years later, he says. And even when he got there, notice verse 18. After 3 years, I went to Jerusalem to visit Cephas and remained with him 15 days. But I saw none other apostle except James, the Lord's brother. So even when he does get to Jerusalem, 3 years later, he's only there for 2 weeks, right? He's there for 15 days, and he only sees two apostles. Now, 15 days wasn't long enough for him to receive all that he's going to pen right here. I mean, it wasn't like this, some incredible apostolic download. No, Paul already had this. That's what he's saying. I lived in Arabia for 3 years. I didn't run to Jerusalem till 3 years later. And when I did, I was only there for 15 days. This gospel, he's saying, came from God. That's the claim that he's making here. I have a message from Christ. It came through divine revelation. Paul, in the beginning of the book of Galatians, is trying to establish that he is truly a servant of God. Go back to Galatians 1:1. Can you remember this passage with me? Paul, an apostle, not from men, nor through man, but through Jesus Christ. Now skip to verse 12. There it is. He's a servant of Christ. Notice verse 12, with a message from Christ. For I did not receive it from any man, nor was I taught it, but I received it through a revelation of Jesus Christ. Paul's calling and Paul's message came from Christ. It's interesting to me, when humans invent religions, they end up glorifying humans. When God communicates his word, it ends up glorifying God. Look at verse 24 just quickly. Look at verse 24. And they glorified God because of me. Paul was a servant of Christ, and he had a message from Christ. There was no human voice behind it. and there was no human explanation that could explain it. How in the world do you get a guy like Paul? Think through who he was. I mean, his name was Saul, Saul of Tarsus. He was a Pharisee. He says, I was a Hebrew of the Hebrews, a Jew of the Jews. He's from the tribe of Benjamin, circumcised the eighth day, more zealous than all my contemporaries. And he was at the top of his pack. He was the head of the class. His parents had a chariot, and on the back, they had this bumper sticker. My son is an honor student of Gamaliel's school. I mean, that's what they had on there. He studied under Gamaliel, the greatest Jewish rabbi of the time. I mean, he was zealous to destroy the church, to crush the faith. Remember who Saul was? I mean, he actually explains it here. Can I show you verse number 13? In verse 13, he says, You heard of my former life in Judaism. I persecuted the church of God violently and tried to destroy it. I was advancing in Judaism beyond many my own age among my own people. So extremely zealous was I for the traditions of my fathers. He was so zealous that he got written orders from the chief priests and scribes to go to various towns and find those people who were Christians. Those people of the way. That's what they were called, the way. It probably comes from John 14:6, where Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. So people who followed Jesus, their first thing they were called, those people of the way. He was given these orders by the chief priests to go into these different towns, and he was finding people who claimed the name of Christ, men, women. He was dragging them off to be killed, to be imprisoned, to have their things confiscated. He was zealous for Judaism. More than all of his contemporaries, what can explain the change in Paul's life other than a divine message from God? Have you ever thought about it? What could take this dude who was wrangling Christians to have them killed and imprisoned, this guy who was a persecutor, and turn him into a preacher? I mean, look at verse number 23. They only were hearing it said, he who used to persecute us is now preaching the faith he once tried to destroy. What else can explain that? Paul gives his little story, his testimony here, to try to say this: listen, I received a message from Christ, and it was an incredible message. I mean, it was against all odds. You know how in yearbooks, at least they used to do this, maybe it's not politically correct anymore and they may have canned this, but when I was in high school, in the yearbook, they had people who were the most popular, and then they put down the most likely to succeed, the most athletic. Do you remember? Anybody else have those? Come on. That was before, yeah, there's a few of us that could select those few. If Paul would have made the yearbook, his would have said this: most unlikely convert. And then they would have had Paul's black and white picture. Most unlikely. Why? Because he hated Christianity. I mean, Paul's conversion was against all odds. He was the least likely to confess Christ. He was cursing Christ. My friends, the gospel sometimes calls us out of what we're stuck in. Paul was stuck in religion. And I'm going to say this: sometimes the gospel calls us out of religion, as much as it may call us out of irreligion. Paul needed to be rescued by the gospel. No one is so good that they don't need grace, and no one is so bad that they can't receive grace. So out of nowhere, against all odds, God in his grace broke into Paul's life. I marked it. I wasn't even sure if I was going to read it, but I will. It's Acts 22. I'm just going to read you a verse or two. This is how Paul describes God breaking into his life. As I was on my way and drew near to Damascus about noon, a great light from heaven suddenly shone around me, and I fell on the ground, and I heard a voice saying to me, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? And he answered, Who are you, Lord? And he said to me, I am Jesus of Nazareth, whom you are persecuting. Now those who were with me saw the light, but did not understand the voice who was speaking to me. And I said, what shall I do, Lord? What happened in Paul's life? Here's this guy. He's on his way to capture some more Christians. Well, God broke in. The most unlikely candidate against all odds, out of nowhere. I mean, in Paul's scope and sequence, it wasn't in his day timer. It wasn't on his Outlook calendar. Oh yeah, I'm going to be halfway down this road to Damascus. I'm going to be stopped. And I'm going to have to fall off my horse, and there's going to be this great light, and it's going to shine on me, and I'm going to go blind, and then next thing you know, I'm going to be preaching about Jesus, getting beat up everywhere I go. Oh, that's a great day. Oh, okay. That's not what happened. That was not on Paul's agenda. It was out of nowhere. But what I love about this text is he says, for me, it was out of nowhere, like God just broke into my life, but in God's heart, I was his before I was ever born. I mean, look at the beauty of this passage. He says in verse number 15, but when he who had set me apart before I was born and who called me by his grace was pleased to reveal his son to me in order that I might preach him among the Gentiles, I did not immediately consult with anyone. What is Paul saying here? He's saying that God, in his good pleasure, in his eternal election, in his loving predestination, set his heart on Paul. I'm going to say every saved person, you may not have seen it coming. It may not have been in your day timer, but God set his heart on you before you were ever born. There may be people here, you don't feel loved. You don't know if people understand you. You feel like an outcast. You're not even sure if you're accepted anywhere. I'm going to tell you something. God rests his heart on those he desires to save. Before Paul was even born, God knew him. God called him. God set him apart. I think it's wonderful how God can take even the things of our life that we view as flaws and failures, that we view as regrets and remorse, and he can take those and turn them for good. Some of you, you live with deep pain in your heart because you've squandered some of the years of your life. You've wasted or frittered away certain things. Or all you can remember are the times in your past where you've fallen on your face. I want to tell you something. God is so great that he can even take your failures and your opposition and your flaws and he can turn those for good. I mean, think about Paul. Here's this guy. He hated Christians. I'm a zealot for the Old Testament scriptures and I'm a Jew and I'm never going to stop and I'm driven. And God says, I'm going to change your course. And I'm going to use all of your Old Testament knowledge to preach me because I am in the Old Testament. I'm going to use all of your zeal and all of your determination to be a missionary for the true gospel. Do you see what God did? He took all of these things that had been building that Paul thought were accumulations against Christ. And instead, God turned them and used them for Christ. And that's what God can do. That is the sovereign power of God, where he takes the hearts of rebels and rascals and he interposes his grace. I love how Karl Barth put it once. He says this, true Christians are victims of a successful surprise attack by God. I love it. God got you. You're his. Before you were ever born, he called you and set you apart. Well, here's Paul, and he's just sharing his testimony of God's grace. God did such an amazing change. It can't be explained any other way. And when you see a turnabout like that, the only thing you can do is just praise God. I wonder if there's some in here, maybe you're not a Christian. Maybe you're just here visiting, or maybe you're investigating Christianity. You say, you know, I know some Christians. I don't know if I believe what they believe, but I'll tell you something. Their lives have changed. Do you know one of the greatest apologetics for the true gospel is the fact that God changes lives? How else are you explaining it? And why is it that that family member or that friend or that neighbor or that classmate has taken such a 180-degree turn? They used to do this. They used to partake in this. They used to be driven by this, but now it's all changed. How else can you explain it? You see, that's what Paul is trying to say here. I was a persecutor of the church. I longed to destroy the faith, but God changed me. It was because it was a message from above. And so people just began to glorify God. He who used to persecute us, verse 23, is now preaching the faith he once tried to destroy, and they glorified God because of me. This chapter is actually, and I could spend a lot of time, but we don't have much left, but verse 13 and 14, before Christ, Paul always talks about himself like I was this, I was that, I was. And then you get to verses 15 and 16 after his conversion, and it's all about who? God. But God called me. But God set me apart. But God. It's all about God. God completely changed everything. He used to be an excellent Pharisee, but what he became was an excellent convert because the grace of God broke in his life. The grace of God ruined his pride. You will never find Christ if you're too proud to crawl over yourself to see him. If you read about Paul, he was all filled with all the things he accomplished, all the things he did, all the things. And God had to humble him, actually took him off his high horse, literally, humbled him so that he would receive a message of grace. You know what I love about Paul's testimony here is that God can save the seemingly unsavable. Man, praise God. I wonder who it is in your life you think, I don't know if they'll ever be saved. They're the staunchest opponent of Christianity. They're the most obstinate, hard-hearted person I know. I don't think they could ever be saved. Oh, my friend, do you know that the staunchest opponent of Christianity, the most obstinate-hearted person you'll ever know, is only a moment away from conversion? That was Paul's story. God, in his grace, broke into his life with a powerful gospel message from above. I'm going to tell you, my friends, the gospel is not tamed. It is not domesticated. It is not caged. The gospel, it says in Romans chapter 1, verse 16, I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ. It is the power of God unto salvation for everyone who believes. The gospel is strong enough to change you, as it was strong enough to change me. Oh, even take a moment right now and think of some of the people in your life who you know have been changed by the gospel. And in your seat right now, give glory to God for that. I think about a guy named George Kreminski, an abusive drunk who would go on binge drinking sprees. He would work construction. He would get his paycheck. He'd take his paycheck, yell at his family and walk out the door, take the paycheck and go spend it for days on drinking. He would just disappear. Family didn't know where. I mean, his wife is trying to make ends meet with all these little kids all around. They practically wore rags. It was a good thing when he was gone drunk, because when he was home drunk, he would beat people. He'd beat them. He'd take their stuff. He'd burn it. He'd wreck the house. I mean, this was George. George wanted nothing to do with God, and he wanted nothing to do with Christ. He wanted nothing to do with Christianity. But one day on one of his drinking binges, he passed out drunk right in front of a house in some town, some bar hop where he finally ended up. Do you know what house he passed out in front of? It was a Christian preacher's house. And that Christian preacher dragged him in, stuck him on the couch until he sobered up and came conscious again. It was there that Christian preacher shared the message of Christ with my grandfather, George Kreminski. And it was that day that George Kreminski's life was changed by the gospel of grace. Because he gave his life to the Lord, and the Lord just changed it. My friends, how long will you persist in your way of living? How long will you live to please people instead of please the one who made you? Oh, Paul says, I am a servant of Christ. I've received a message of Christ. The implied invitation from this text is this: will you respond to Christ? I want to close with a story of Jesus. It comes from Matthew 21. It's the last week of Jesus' life. He's in Jerusalem. Some of the chief priests and elders of the people came to him and asked, "By what authority are you doing these things, and who gave you this authority?" Jesus answered, "I will ask you a question. And if you tell me the answer, then I will also tell you by what authority I do these things." So Jesus looks at these chief priests and elders, and he asks them a question. He says, "The baptism of John, was it from heaven or from men?" This morning, I'd like to reframe the question. Imagine if Jesus was here and he were speaking about this text. What would he say? He'd probably look at you. Imagine you're the only one in the room. It's you and Jesus. And he'd look at you after what we've just read and what we've just studied. And he'd say, "The gospel message that Paul preached, is it from heaven or is it from men?" And he'd let the silence kind of settle its weight on you. Because you do have to respond to a gospel message. Paul claimed to be a servant of Christ with a message from Christ. Now you must respond to Christ. And so imagine him asking that. "This gospel message you just heard, is it from heaven or is it from men?" Well, let's go back to Jesus' story. The chief priests and elders said to themselves, "If we say it's from heaven, he's going to say, why didn't you believe?" So Paul's gospel, is it from heaven or is it from men? Because if you say it's from heaven, as the scriptures claim it to be, then the next question is, then why won't you believe? Oh, my friend, Paul was a servant of Christ. Paul had a message from Christ. And he calls each one of us to respond to Christ. Will you do that today?